This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
So I am here with Ken Foray, an incredibly versatile American actor widely known for his role as Peter Washington in George Romero's 1978 film Dawn of the Dead, as well as Roger Rockmore on Nickelodeon's Keenan and Kel, amongst countless other well-known movies and television series. A personal shout-out for you were in the A-Team in an episode. I love the A-Team growing up. Like Knight Rider, all kinds of like really well-known stuff. So Ken, appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
I know you're very busy. I wanted to start out by first of all thanking you for participating in this incredible documentary, Horror Noir. Huge fan of that. I'm so glad Phil at Fangoria kind of like got that kickstarted. And for those who don't know that's listening or haven't seen it, first of all, I can't recommend it enough. Second of all, just a rough overview. It's the untold history of African Americans through their connection to the horror film genre. And aside from yourself, it features people like Jordan Peele, Tony Todd, Rachel True, and more. So can you talk about your experience working on that film and being a part of that, like such an important part of the horror genre, iconic?
Well, I got a call, and they wanted me to work on it. I had various talks with a few of the producers throughout the years. As a matter of fact, I did a tribute to Dwayne Jones in Salem, and there were some connections between those the group that put that on and the same producers for Horror Noir. So I knew about them. That I think it's Graveyard Sisters.
Yeah.
And so they contacted me, and I was interested, of course. And I got a chance to work with Keith David, which was great.
Yeah.
It's history. It's a part of history. And it wasn't just Blacks in Horror, even though that was the title and the theme, but it was just Blacks in Cinema.
Right.
You know, which, you know, is a, you might say, an up and down, maybe tragic, heroic venture,
right,
in many ways. So I think it's an enlightening piece. I think people should see it. I think people should I don't think it's getting enough. I know it's getting some press. I know it's playing some places. I think Shudder is
that's where I saw it.
Shudder has it, but I don't think it's getting enough traction.
I couldn't agree more.
It should. Because it's an important part of, especially today, in terms of explaining the African American story in a different light,
right,
a different setting, of course, and and this is going to be more and more an issue as we move forward in the next 20 to 30 years because of this present situation, of course.
Right.
And I think there should be understanding and communication and on both sides to what the issues are, what they have been, how we got here, and and where we go from here. And I think Horror Noir is certainly a beginning for that, for many people.
Yeah.
Many people, have, of course, have, you know, somewhat educated to the history of African Americans in this country and how they've been used, abused, and celebrated,
yeah,
even. But not everyone, and right, a vast majority of the people don't. Even many African Americans don't.
Yeah, of course.
So it's an educational journey, and I think anything that's going to educate our populace is a good thing.
Couldn't agree more. That's why I wanted to start with this right off the bat. It's such an important film. So thank you for being a part of that.
Yeah.
And that segues into, and I'm not going to dwell on Dawn of the Dead because I know you've talked to that until I can't even imagine.
I'm gray in the face.
Gray in the face. But, so you mentioned Dwayne Jones, who played Ben, and that was such an important role at that time.
Yes.
And, I remember talking to George, like I mentioned, about 10 years ago in this hotel about that. And a couple of questions around that.
Okay.
One is that I have heard, and I really regret that I didn't get to ask this to George, but I've heard George say he didn't pick Dwayne because he was African American. He picked him because he was the best actor for the role. But then I've heard people like John Landis, director of American Werewolf in London, say bullshit. Like, he knew what he was doing. He was making this statement. Do you know about the truth behind that?
No.
Okay.
To be frank.
Yes.
Absolutely. I just don't know. I made a statement when George died, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I was interviewed by someone, or someone had me write something. And I said it really didn't matter because he picked the best person for the role.
Yeah.
And that in itself was heroic.
Yeah.
It was before the times. I think before that it was Sidney in Lilies of the Field.
Right.
Other than that, I think it was Hattie McDaniels for Gone with the Wind.
Right.
There was nothing, and so for George to say that he picked the best actor for that part in itself says something about who George was and what he thought and how he... what kind of man he was in terms of because he took a risk that many didn't and wouldn't,
right?
And especially in 1978, sorry, 68,
right?
It's 78
too, for you,
for me. But in 68, he not many people were willing to take that risk. Sidney was the only one. I don't know how that evolved. I was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah,
when Lilies of the Field came out, and went to see it right away.
Yeah,
and so I kind of, it was an exciting moment, but I knew Dwayne. We were in the same theater / activist group in Harlem.
Yeah,
and Dwayne and I weren't. We saw each other almost every day.
Yeah.
We saw each other almost every weekend. We were very active. We were doing a lot of things. And there was a movie house at that point on 125th Street. And I passed by one day, and there was Dwayne's picture all over the place. All over, in the lobby cards everywhere, Dwayne's at. I said, my God, look at this. So I ran down the street. Our studios, or our theater, was about three blocks down 125th Street. So it wasn't that far, but I sprinted down. What's going on? Dwayne, you're in this movie. He said, shh. Leave me shooting. Why am I going to shoot? You're all splattered all over the lobby of a film, of a movie house. Everybody's going to know why you're telling me to be quiet. He's a strange thing. But I spent one of them just to talk a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't want to stick to. I like sometimes you'll say something and it will remind me of something else and I'll go off on something.
I love that.
I was with Dwayne on one of the most enjoyable moments of my life. And this was long after National Black Theater, with that group that we were involved in. I was studying acting with the Michael Schulman Gallery downtown. I had a guy by the name of Charlie Adler and Melvina Peoples. Melvina was a singer, kind of a jazz singer. Charlie was, I don't know what Charlie was doing. Charlie was everywhere. He was a computer whiz. He was a big, kind of a Jackie Gleason-like guy.
Sure,
You know, Jewish guy. You know, I have to say Jewish guy because, and I hate to make that, stipulation, but
it's a
Charlie was funny. Anyway, they were opening a part of 42nd Street at that point, from 9th Avenue to 10th Avenue, I believe.
Yeah.
42nd Street, and it was going to be these annex theaters from all of the major off-rate Broadway houses. They were going to have annex theaters on 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And so everybody had Chuckle Warehouse, Circle in the Square, all of these great off-Broadway theaters had an annex there, and they were building these. And so at the same time, it was during Mondale's president run. He was running for president, Jimmy Carter's vice president. So Mondale was coming down to launch it, it's a celebration. They had a street fair on 10th Avenue to cut off all the traffic. So people were going back. So this is a great day if you're a New Yorker to just go have something to eat, have something to drink, enjoy the music, enjoy the crowds, hear a few. It was a wonderful time. And Duane had the Black Theater Alliance annex.
Yeah.
And, we went to a few places and I saw Duane. I said, oh, come on, guys. I know Duane. I know this guy. So I went in. I said, Duane. They said, hey, how you doing? So we sat there and we drank and we smoked a little grass and we talked, and people came in and came out, but we stayed with Duane, the three of us, and there were some interesting characters that came through. These were these Roger Furman, who was a director, but these were guys, they're small theater directors, but they were very, very avant-garde, stylish, and creative and flamboyant, and when they came into a room, you knew they were there.
Yeah.
And they came in the room, and they certainly had conversation to match their appearance. And so we were having a great time just talking to these guys, and they're talking. We're laughing and joking, and we're drinking wine, and at the end of it, Mondale came down and opened it for all this gala affair. And about 10 o'clock that night, Duane said, 9 o'clock at night, Duane said, why don't you come up to my house, you guys? Okay. Went up to his house. He lived on, at that point, the West End. I think Riverside, somewhere like that. Very, very, very nice digs in New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he pulled out, fed us pie and ice cream, and we sat around, and there were about five or six of us. And Charlie was sitting there, and I don't know how this came up. Something came up, and then we were talking. So he said, Charlie, how you feel about it? Charlie said, I feel like I should be singing We Shall Overcome. Everybody fell out laughing. It was harmless. It was authentic. It was meant in the best of humor.
Right.
And we accepted it like that. And we all just fell out of our chairs.
That's amazing.
It was one of those great, great days. And from the time we were on 42nd Street and spent the day with Duane, as the last time I saw him. The next time I heard anything about Duane, I was in Hollywood, but I come to New York to shoot a film. I was staying 50th Street at Howard Johnson's or Ramada or something. It's a low budget film, you know, but good people. And I just finished, and I was leaving in about 3 or 4 hours to go to the airport and get back to California. And I wanted to walk around Times Square and Broadway and, you know, like take another whiff of New York and look around and just say goodbye to it and get on the plane. Yeah? And I saw this young lady on the corner, and she had a tie-dye T-shirt, kind of, you know, tied in a little bow at the waist. And nobody was wearing tie-dye T-shirts at this point. She had this big afro. And this. So I'm going that way, so I just passed by. I wasn't going to say anything, but she was handing out some kind of flyer or something. And she said, "Hey, don't you, I said, yeah. Said, "Oh, I'm a member of National Black Theater." I said, "Oh, really? Oh. Okay, how's everybody up there? Send them my love, give them my greetings." Said, "What are you doing?" I said, she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just finishing a film. I'm flying out in about 2 or 3 hours, something like that, 3 hours. She said, "Oh, that's too bad." I said, "Well, why?" She said, "Well, we're having a wake for Dwayne Jones." I said, "Oh, my God, what are you talking about?" She said, "Well, he died." I said, "Oh, my God, no, God." That's how I found out he died.
Wow.
And right in this, I think that was, I can't even name the street. It was 44th Street and Broadway, 6th Avenue.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, talking about Dwayne, and then leading in, here we are 10 years later to Dawn of the Dead. Another, you know, George is just incredible at the way he slips in these like political, socioeconomical, you know, things. And so my two questions for you about that. One is, did you feel any trepidation or were you nervous at all walking in after Dwayne had done, you know, such an amazing job in Night of the Living Dead, and here you are stepping in like 10 years later?
Absolutely not.
You were ready to rock it.
Absolutely not. I, you know, Dwayne and I were cut from the same cloth in that way. I spent so many years with Dwayne.
Yeah.
This was the time of the Civil Rights Movement.
Right, yeah.
We were around at that point of the SCLC, the Urban League, the NAACP, SNCC, CORE, the Panthers, the Five Percenters, the various Muslim groups were there. I mean, it was a hotbed.
Yeah.
For young African Americans to say, well, when the African Americans were changing their names at that point.
Right.
I mean, I'm not gonna mention names, but you know that people were not called Rashid before
that. Right.
They were not called Abdul or Muhammad.
Right.
Before that. And so we were in the hotbed of that. So if Dwayne performed in 1968, I'm certainly going to perform in 78.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt about it. We were both cut from the same cloth in that manner.
Yeah. You know? It shows in your portrayal, too. I mean, you come through like you own that film. Yeah. And my last question is, in the original script, from what I've read, at the ending, there was an alternate ending where, you know, you're on the roof with Fran and she's like, "Get in the helicopter, you have the gun to your head."
Yeah.
And from what I've read, the alternate ending was you actually shot yourself.
Yes.
So what, I don't know if you talked with George about that or what was the decision there?
You know, it's so many years ago.
Sure, yeah.
And, as like any story, as the years pass.
For sure, yeah.
you know, there people have different opinions about what exactly happened.
Sure.
And there's always, you know, I'll give you an example. I was watching, with Mel Gibson, the Scottish.
Braveheart.
Braveheart.
Sure.
Braveheart. And so he, you know, was deceived and that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden I'm watching the people and say, yes, William Wallace, he killed 30 men. And by the time he gets to the next couple of guys, he killed 100 men.
Right.
So I think that, you know, in this situation, I talked to George just before we were going to shoot that. And I remember, and my memory would be faulty at this. I mean, this is,
of course,
40 years ago,
yeah,
for me. You know,
for sure.
It's been a lot of things have happened since then. So
yeah.
my memory may not be as strong as it was when I was in my 20s.
Understood.
But I remember talking to George and saying, and he said, you know, it's going to be a dark ending. And I think he said, yeah, it is. He said, and I think he said, you think, what do you, if we discuss whether light or dark should be an up ending, or, you know, should be this. And he said, let's make it an up ending. Yeah, you don't kill yourself. That's what I remember.
Right.
Now, someone else may come with another story.
Yeah.
And they could be right.
Sure.
You know, I'm not perfect, so I can make a mistake.
Yeah.
I have in my life. But I seem to remember that. And the only thing about the escape that I can tell you is that... I mean, they tested Galen's head. Of course, everybody knows this.
Right,
they took
yeah.
the dummy and put the head up in the chopper just to see what it was like.
Right.
All right. So, when I tried to escape, I reached for the rudders of the helicopter.
Yeah.
Pulled me, come down. The guy who's really flying the helicopter is going. Because I was pulling the damn helicopter.
My God.
We were going to decapitate the entire myself and half the people on that roof if I'd have kept it up.
Thank God that didn't happen.
Thank God it didn't happen. I don't know what made me release it because I could have.
Right.
I really wasn't getting that. I was really disturbing the balance of the chopper. So
yeah. Well, I asked that because, you know, I remember the first time I saw Night of the Living Dead, and mm-hmm. that was such an important movie to me,
mm-hmm.
and I was gutted, you know, mm-hmm. at the end where mm-hmm. Dwayne makes it, and then it's just like the rednecks, like, pick him off, and you see him hooked away, and part of me, though, I love when there's dark endings, like, I mean, happy endings are great, but I like when it leaves, because that was, like, a reality.
It might have been great. It might have worked well.
Yeah.
You know?
But... I was like, yeah, because I, you know, yeah, he made it, you know. Like
I sat in the audience like you did
yeah.
in 1968,
yeah,
and I knew Dwayne was going to make it.
Yeah.
And I said, God, thank God he's going to make it, God. And when he took that shot.
Yes.
I think he shot him between the eyes. Yeah. I, like everyone else in the world, went, oh, God, no.
I know. And I'm from a zombie, the little... Hick squads walking but it spoke to the time, and George did I think he made the right decision with that, but I was, like I said, really glad that in Dawn, like, mm-hmm. we see you, like, and you make it.
We survived. We did well. That film, somebody sent me something, I think it was a Google alert, and they called it the greatest zombie film ever made, one of the greatest horror films ever made.
Oh, yeah.
It just doesn't seem to get the credit in certain circles. I don't know why. But it ran number one in the box office receipts in Variety the first 3 weeks that it ran.
Yeah.
That's a heck of a statement.
It's incredible.
For a film
that
cost under, really, whatever Richard says it cost. They did, well, let's say it cost $1 million, all right?
Sure, yeah.
And you can tell it's a low budget film. You can see it's, and this film carried for number one for 3 weeks. That's a tremendous. I don't think any horror film. Maybe the one where they were in the woods and they were.
Blair Witch.
Blair Witch. Yep. Maybe Blair Witch carried for a while. I'm not quite sure. But I don't think many horror films with that kind of budget has ever carried variety.
Yeah.
For 3 weeks.
And I think people in the know, though, I don't know if you've heard of or seen Eli Roth did a series, History of Horror.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, well, so the first episode's about zombies. And, you know, they start with Night of the Living Dead, and then they get to Dawn of the Dead. Mm. And everyone across the board, from Quentin Tarantino to Rob Zombie to Greg Nicotero, they're like, this is the gold standard. Night of the Living Dead was a phenomenal film, but Dawn of the Dead is hands down the best zombie movie of all time. And I couldn't agree more. Like, so I think those that like appreciate the genre, and not just the genre, but the art of film, hands down. So,
Unfortunately, there are those who don't. Find it very strange.
Yeah.
Be polite.
Yes. So I wanted to ask you, it's a very small role you had, but I've got to say, one of my favorite scenes of you, I've watched it over and over in the Halloween reboot.
Joe Grizzly,
bitch. Like, I love that scene. You kill me. You're like the only dude ever to stand up to Michael Myers. Like, I mean, really, except the final girls. But was there, during that scene, did you have any creative input in that? Or was that strictly Rob? Like,
well, Rob, the dialogue was something about the, I get past
the burrito,
peace and peace.
Yeah,
and better get on the hills and
take the arches
or something. Yeah, like that. And that was Rob's stuff.
Okay,
and the the also the Struthers Martin is why I really really wanted to do it. Struthers Martin's role. This line. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
So I wondered that was Rob, and I thank him for that. But the rest of that was me. I just felt it, man. I called him Susie.
Yeah, right.
I said, you know, you fucking witch, Joe Grizzly, bitch.
Hey, wait a minute. I got something for you. Like, I had a feeling. That's what I wanted to ask. Yeah. Like, how much of that was, man, you?
It was one of those things that you're there and you're in the moment and you're in the moment. You're not conscious of it, really. You're just going to say, I'm going with it. Whatever happens, happens. And we knew we wanted it to be a horrific killing.
Oh, yeah, which it was.
And we wanted a battle,
which I
felt I had to kind of, edge it on a little bit, and I did.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great scene.
Yeah.
So, but that dialogue, I just a big fan.
Yeah, that went viral. Man, that was everywhere.
Yeah, memes everywhere.
But. Oh, man. I had no, because I, like I said, just popped out. But I've gone overseas, and people had T-shirts.
Yeah.
People told me, I can't tell you how many people have come to me and said that in their offices, when they walk in the morning and they're having a coffee, and it'd be, this is accountants, and it'd be 50 accountants, or 100 people, or whatever, 30 people here, and the machinists, or whatever they do.
Yeah.
And they say, put that down, I'm Joe Grizzly, bitch. No, I'm Joe Grizzly. Yeah. And they will tell me, it goes on for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever. It went crazy, man.
Such a great line.
I'm telling you. I had no idea, but it's one of my favorite lines at this point.
I'm so glad. I'm driving up here and I have that print, and I'm like, I want him to say it right there, but I can't because it's Dawn of the Dead. But that line's so awesome.
No. Heck, that was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, man. Them have been around a long time.
Yeah, very true.
I tell you a story. Someone was talking to me the other night friend of mine just died. Just cut this out if you want. A friend of mine just died. And his name was Jerry Black. And Jerry, if you saw his face, you would recognize him from something. Say, I know this guy.
Right, sure.
Jerry worked a lot, you know. He was working on Hill Street Blues.
Okay.
And he might have a line here and there. You know, I guess he was sort of like a day player, or he might have a semi-regular role. He didn't work that much, but when he did work, he might have a line or two, you know, maybe a line of walking, yes, sir. He was always seen. And just to show you how crazy how my business is and how things get, I'm always watching. When you're in the business, you find yourself watching the extras. You're watching the, continuity.
Yeah.
You know, instead of watching the films. Yeah. So you're like, what's going on back there? Oh, I see that. I'm reading behind the scene.
Right.
Instead of what's going on in front of it. And they have won all these Emmys, you know. And so they win the captain's office, and I forget what his name, I forget the name of him, I forget his character's name, but nice man. And then the captain's office of Hill Street Blues. And someone left the Emmy on the file cabinet as you come in his office. So you can't miss it. Everybody that comes in has to pass this file cabinet. Everyone who goes out has to pass this file cabinet. And right on top of it is the Emmy that they won.
Oh, my God.
It's in bloopers and beef or something. Mistake shows, Hollywood films and TV, and he, Jerry, this was my friend Jerry Black, because this is just like Jerry.
Yeah,
Jerry passes the file, and as he passes the file, very deftly, he just goes and out the door.
Wow,
that quickly.
That's incredible.
So just a little Hollywood backstory.
I love that stuff. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's like the stuff I really enjoy. Just a couple more questions, because
Sure.
I want to be respectful of your time. So, you know, we recently lost Sid Haig, and big tragedy for for the horror world and outside of that. I know you worked with him on Devil's Rejects.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd worked with him elsewhere. Did you have any kind of relationship with Sid outside of that, or any memories of working with him, or were you guys not really that close?
No, Sid and I, we had a relationship where we enjoyed each other.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I had fun times with it. We talk occasionally over the phone. I call him.
Yeah.
He call me occasionally. We say, hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
What's going on? Everything good? We talked over the years. I've known Sid since, I knew Sid before Rejects, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
But I passed crossed several times before Rejects. And he was an interesting man to get to know.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Fair enough. Thank you. I really appreciated your scenes with him in Devil's Rejects. They were a lot of fun. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, just like I said, a couple more. I read that your mom celebrated her 90th birthday this year.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, that's phenomenal. I'd also read that you were getting up at like 5 a.m. to do yoga with her.
How did you get all this information?
I do my research.
I'm telling you, boy, you are. This is a little scary. Yes.
I take these very seriously. Like I said, you're one of the gentlemen I've always wanted to get to, and one of my last like bucket lists.
Yeah.
So my question is, first of all, again, like I said, congrats on her being 90. Is like yoga? I know when I ran into you in the lobby, you just finished working out,
which is
awesome. Is yoga part of like your daily routine? And
I started doing yoga, I think, in California. Many, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And it was just, I bought a book Yeah. Followed the instructions and found it very relaxing.
Yeah.
And I've used it, you know, occasionally here and there.
Yeah.
Whether I've, you know, I went to a few classes at one point.
Sure.
It's not anything that I do as religiously as I should.
Yeah.
And I spent months doing it, and then I won't do it for a while. My mom had a sciatica nerve problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, that starts, for her it started anyway, she has degenerative lower back, so her lower back and tailbone, had that spine there, you can't do anything about. And so she was having these pains, and she would yell and scream and, you know, in pain in the kitchen if she's washing dishes, that kind of. And so I heard about it, and I said, well, let's try to find some way to fix it.
Yeah.
And we went to a chiropractor, and that worked for about a year. I took her to an acupuncturist, and she didn't really like that. I thought it was doing wonders for her, but she really didn't like that.
Yeah.
For some reason. And finally I said, okay. I found a yoga studio that was close to her home, within, you know, 10 minutes driving at the most. And I said, and I called them, and I said, do you have anybody who would like to, that can come to someone's house for someone? They sent someone over. And I started her working yoga. Then we started going to the studio privately.
Yeah.
For private lessons. And then I started working with her. And I started back, I started to do it again, working with her. And getting her to get up. I said, listen, because I know that once, you know, changing someone's daily routine.
Yeah.
Or what they've done for most of their lives, yeah. You know. And what happens once you rise at 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and the things that you're bombarded with in terms of surprises, or we have to go here, or that this happened, or we have to pay a bill, or we want to go to the doctor, or we want to pick up a pharmacy, or we have to go shopping, or we're invited to this, or we have to do this, and that. So if you do it at 5 o'clock in the morning, there's no disturbances.
Yeah.
You can get it done, and you need to get it done every morning. And she, since the yoga, she hasn't had any sciatica pain.
Amazing.
So that's what I was after. That's what I got. And, you know, so that,
I'm glad to hear that for her. I teach a lot of meditation myself and things of that nature. Yeah. So yoga's helped me. I have back problems too. I actually just started physical therapy, and it's a wonder cure. So
it is. It really is. It does. You know, you're not only dealing with your joints and your muscles and your tendons, you're also dealing with your internal organs as well.
Yeah.
So everything's being touched.
Yeah.
And if you have a problem, you're going to soon know about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So I'm going to cut a bunch of stuff. I just have a couple of personal questions that I don't think are too personal. But just about Ken, getting to know Ken. Mm-hmm. What's one of the most beautiful, awe-inspiring moments you've had in your life? I'm sure there have been many, but is there a particular, just really, you know, wow kind of moment that stands out to you above the rest, or is up there with other big, just really beautiful moments in your life?
Gee, that's a hard question. One of the most beautiful moments in my life. Having my son.
And how old is he now?
He's passed.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I apparently didn't do my research on that.
No.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Sorry. And, I tell you, an interesting time.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I had an uncle who, was a journalist for, he went to Indiana University and school journalism, and ran the Canadian University student newspaper. He went to Chicago and was on a reporter for the Chicago Daily Defender, I think one of the second or third largest black newspapers in the country. And because he couldn't get a job anywhere else, right. He did, you know, his assistant editor, or his assistant, I guess assistant editor for the student newspaper at IU was immediately put on at the Indianapolis Star or the Indianapolis News, but he couldn't get on it. So he worked for the Defender, and he became a very important individual in the city of Chicago. He was on Mayor Daley's Commission on Human Rights. He was in the Social Registry of Who to Know in Chicago. And so it was amazing, because he'd take his wife and I out every Tuesday and Friday for dinner to a different place in Chicago. And sometimes this is not the greatest moment in my life. I can name many, I guess.
I'm sure.
Now that I get the chance to run a few things through my head here, I've got a few to reflect here. I've got a few other things I could tell you about that are far more impacting. But this is such an interesting story. So we would go places, and the politicians would come to this table. Okay, James, we need you to, Fori, we need this. We're the mayor, the city council. Are they going to move the airport? Are we going to build it? It's like sitting in on a city council meeting almost every Tuesday and Friday. Mm. At a different restaurant. And sometimes he would go to some restaurants just for the apple pie a la mode. We go to an Italian restaurant and say, well, no, you don't want to eat it. It's not good Italian food. But the apple pie a la mode is the best in town.
So worth it.
And we'll have it. And I had my first pastrami on rye, where I had to reach in a pickle, in a barrel to get my pickle.
Yeah.
Sawdust on the floor, mm-hmm. and a Heineken, and with my uncle in Chicago.
Yeah,
he was a tremendous influence on a lot of our lives, with his nephews and nieces, and he was a great man, and well known. So I enjoyed being around him. Learned a lot from him. Wish I'd have spent more time with him. It's one of my regrets.
Yeah.
And I guess there've been some pretty exciting moments, I guess. I don't know.
I'm sure there's some.
I could pick. Yeah. I'm trying to find something that I can spin into a story for you. Memorable. How about my first girl? No, absolutely not. I would say probably having a chance. I'll tell you something recently.
Yeah.
Really recently. I've found that I have a talent to write.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm surprised by it, you know, that it's that good. That, you know, I have some stuff that's being looked at and appreciated by some of the top people in the industry.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, and I'd written some things, you know, in school.
Yep.
And, you know, people kind of, you know, took a look and said, oh. But I kind of ignored it because, you know, my focus was somewhere else. I wanted to do some other things, and I was focused on certainly not on writing. And but I, you know, in my later years, I found that I've come back to it, and it's appreciated by a lot of people.
That's
As a matter of fact, it's considered to be as good as some of the best that's out there. So I'm really happy about that.
So a potential book we might see one day?
No. Man, are you kidding me? The scripts that I write. I had no idea. I wrote a huge project. It's a series.
Yeah. I'd read about that, six-part or something.
Oh, what the hell did you read about that? God, you're getting all over, boy. I'm not going to quit what would be my big no. So, but it's really draining.
Yeah.
It really is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was quite surprised. I'm writing a serial killer script now, and still,
yeah,
you know, even though it's nowhere near the length or the depth of the series that I wrote,
yeah,
but it's still just there is a pool of emotions, and
oh yeah,
your brain starts to go, and you start to perspire, and after a while, it drains you. It's work. It's definitely work.
It is,
and I didn't realize how difficult it could be on your endurance.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah.
You know. And so I've that's been one of the major surprises in the last few years.
That's so cool.
That the last 15 years, something like that, I have that kind of talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a talent. I as I mentioned, I think earlier, that's what I do for a living is writing.
Yes.
I have 3 books published. I'm with Simon & Schuster.
Yes.
And when I finished or was like halfway through my second book, I was living in Canada and married and I'm since divorced. But I remember saying to my ex-wife, I'm like, I'm never writing a book again. Because like you said, it's so draining. And she laughed at me. I'm like, what's funny about that? She goes, you don't remember saying that when you finished your first book? And here I am now, 3 books out, and I'm working on 2 at the same time.
Yes.
It's
yes. I've got a cousin that says, do the autobiography.
Yeah.
Your fans weed it up.
They would.
And I said, no.
You need to get like a ghostwriter or something.
That'd be a fictional story.
So last 2, very quickly. Yeah. On the other side of beautiful, and you can go either way with this, either on a personal level, what is one of the most frightening, scariest experiences you've had? Or if you're not comfortable going that route, what frightens you most in this world, like in general? And I leave that to you, which way you want to go with that.
You know, there are many things that I'm concerned about,
sure,
of course. Like anyone else, I'll sit and I'll talk to people, I'll talk to family, friends, strangers, or, you know, at an event, wherever I am, you know, and a dinner party, whatever. And I have the same concerns, the same issues as most people.
Yeah.
You know, I have my opinions, they have theirs.
Sure.
Know. Of course, I have some friends that are of conspiracy theorists, and I say, okay, listen, all right, it's enough. I disagree with you. I don't want to hear any more of it, but I'll fight for your right to say it. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
But this is what I would... this is probably... pertains strictly to what has happened to me.
Yeah.
I was 9, 8, 9, somewhere around there. And I grew up in a pretty combative area called Lockville Gardens. Mm-hmm. It was a project, but it wasn't... This was a project built for executives.
Sure.
They were, I forget who exactly it was for, but this place was as lavish as you could get. I mean, this is something special. Yeah. If you could see it and have seen it in its heyday, it was just gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I mean, there was a... well, anyway, I'm not going to describe Lockville Garden. You can look it up if you want. But
sure.
It was something special. And I think it was built not for poor people, not even the middle class. This is for, I think lawyers? I'm not sure if it was... I can't think of who... I don't remember. There's a history. It wasn't built for poor people or middle class people. It was built for the upper tier people that wanted to live close to Indianapolis downtown. Sure. And so for some reason, you know, we were in it. And it was filled with African Americans. And so, you know, I'd go to other places in the city, my guide cousins, and they say, you know, so you get in a little tussle with some guys, you know, arguments. Your cousin can't fight, get picked on by a guy, so you got to go and say, hey, listen, don't bother my cousin. And they say, where are you from? I'm from Lockville. Oh, you can fight. What? What? Does that mean I can fight because I'm not? It's true. But So... You know, I kind of, you know, we had a bit of pride, you know. It was a source of, I guess, that community in Lockville was a community that, you know, built strong individuals, strong men. You know? And, of course, as young boys, we followed behind those men.
Yeah.
And so I was, one day, I was with my cousins on the north side. And my cousins on the north side were not very aggressive in terms of, you know, defending themselves. They'd rather take a run. And don't fault them for that, but that's their personality, you know. And we were coming from playing baseball. We had our gloves and a ball or something. And there were two white guys with us. I don't know. I can't tell you how we got together or why we were walking together. But one was huge. I mean, if I was 8 or 9, this guy was 15.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah.
And he was probably about 6. He looked like he was 6'3", 6'4" at that point. And the other guy was pretty big, too. And as we were walking, he started to say bad things about African Americans and using the N-word. And I'll never forget how I kept looking for something to hit this guy with.
Yeah.
A brick. Pipe, anything. I was so enraged. As a young kid, I was so enraged that I wanted to do what I could to this guy, any way I could. And I'll never forget the frustration I had that I couldn't find anything.
Yeah.
And I just, that was like, and that stuck with me.
Yeah.
That stuck with me. I don't know. I could, you know, in terms of the race relations, I can name 100 incidents up till today
that I could
talk about. Most African Americans can, and I certainly can.
Yeah.
But that one, as a young kid, I think was my first example of being helpless and having
those kind of things said to me,
yeah,
and those kind of things, not being able to respond because he was so big.
Yeah.
I couldn't beat him. I couldn't hit him. Not with my fist, because I wasn't going to hurt him.
Right.
But I certainly could hit him with something. Just to turn it around, I saw him. Oh, I could give you stories about this. I mean, being an African American in this country.
Yeah.
You know, I had I'm gonna give you two stories real quick. Yeah. I had there's a semi-pro baseball team in our city called the Indianapolis Indians.
Yeah.
And I was passing by and I don't know why I turned a corner to the entrance of the building. And they hadn't opened the gates. And there had to be about 50 people there, all white. And all of a sudden, this tall, lanky, you know, black guy and his buddy came up. And they got right in front of the doorway of the, you know, one of the doorways, and they started to harass them. And they smacked a few of the people, hit them. They did, you know, just, I'm standing back.
Yeah.
I'm behind everyone else because I'm not going in. First of all, secondly, I'm kind of like a distant observer of what's going on
here. Yeah, sure.
So I said, "What the hell?" And he was just—I said, "Why is this guy doing this?" And he was just being an asshole. He just wanted to bully people. Angry white people, I guess. You know, that was his issue. And there was a guy that came up. Now, I know this guy. I don't know him. But I know his. I know who he is.
Sure.
I know his family. I know he has a family of about 5 or 6 brothers. I know this was a family you didn't mess with because they were very good with their hands.
Yeah.
And he saw what was going on. It's another black guy. Now, out of all these people, there's the two guys that are creating the problems. Little me over in the corner going, "What?" And the other guy that's passing by and sees it and stops. That's from the family of black guys that really can, as we call, thump.
Yes.
Or fight.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And he sees what goes on. He walks up to the guy. And he says, he faces him down. Says, "Now do it to me." You know, "Do it to me." And the guy knew that he wasn't, I don't think he knew who he was.
Yeah.
But he knew that this guy could handle himself and said and challenged him. He knew that he was in trouble. Somebody he's gonna have to fight this guy. So he walked away, him and his buddy. Now the guy that he'd been smacking said, "Thanks, Mr. I didn't want to kill him."
Ah, oh my God.
As they walked, they opened the gates, people flowed in.
Yeah, right.
I said, "Oh God." It was one of those moments. And I said, "Gee, it's like, isn't life strange?" Now, give you another one. Yeah. Just another one. Some on this subject. Because we had started with Horror Noir. This is part of who I am.
Yeah.
I'm in, as a matter of fact, the stadium is here. Across the street, about half a block, is a supermarket. It's in the Midwest, it's called Kroger.
Yeah.
Out in, I don't know if you have it here, but in the West Coast, it's called Ralph's.
Yeah.
It's a major. When you get to the Midwest, it's huge.
Sure.
And when you get to the West Coast, it's called Ralph's. It may be called something else because it's probably, you know, I don't know what you guys have up here, but, you know, Atlantic Richfield or something like that, a Standard or something like that.
Yeah, all that.
So anyway, this is a huge, huge company.
Yeah.
I'm down south, it's called Piggly Wiggly. It's not Kroger, but it's a franchise called Piggly Wiggly, which I never heard of until I got down
went down south, Piggly Wiggly. What happened to him? Anyway, so I would go there because I didn't live. All of this stadium, the supermarket, it's a major street in Indianapolis called 16th Street. I lived about half a mile from that.
Yeah.
And I had to pass by, you know, to go different places. I want to go to hamburgers. We passed by driving, going out to the inn and stuff.
Yeah.
I used to run around with my friends going to the, you know, soybean trucks would come every with the silos and you smell like crap. Ah. So that was Indiana for you. So I would go into the Kroger occasionally to get something, you know. So I went in one day. And this woman, she just looked like, you know that boxy, have you ever heard of Betty Crocker?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you see the woman on the box of Betty Crocker?
Yeah.
Has little blonde hair, and it's just perfect, and she looks so nice, and, you know, just like everybody's grandmother, all
right? Yeah, right.
So this woman reminded me of Betty Crocker. And she's always nice, seemed to be nice to everybody. And they caught this little kid stealing candy. You know, who didn't go in and try to grab a candy bar with your kid, all right?
Yeah.
So it's a little red-haired kid, white kid, or something like that, blonde-haired white kid. And she went to, you know, I'm in line. They bring him up, and she said, oh, don't, you know, he's just a kid. He's just taking a little candy. You know, don't do that. She's going to bat for this kid. She don't know him, but she's going. And I'm watching. I said, well, that's nice of her. You know, she's a nice lady. That, you know, looks like Betty Crocker.
Yeah.
She's Betty. She's a nice Betty Crocker personality as well. Yeah. This is Betty Crocker. This is a nice woman. Lo and behold, not a month later, same age as that little white kid, this little black kid. Same age, they had to be about seven.
Right.
Six. Caught stealing some candy. They bring him up. You would think this kid was John Dillinger.
Oh, man.
She went, I'm looking, I'm saying, what the hell? This is the same kind of thing. This is candy. And what could he be doing? Why are you looking at him like he's a criminal?
Right.
And you didn't look at this other kid like he's a criminal.
Right.
Why you want to lock this guy up and you don't want to lock this kid up?
Yeah.
Why do you treat this? And I said, well, maybe you're not Betty Crocker.
Yeah.
You know, after all, you know? And so, you know, so those are some of the, if I want to talk about moments that impacted my life,
yeah,
you know, in a strange, you know, something, you know, like the baseball thing, that's the strange
right.
way, you know. But
right.
you know, I've had. I give you another example just to show you that it's not, it's how complex it can be.
Sure, I appreciate
it. My mother would take her drive-in and. Well, she took the drive. They had a tire went out or something on the way out of the drive-in or something on the car. So they're on the side of the road. A lot of people passed them by, especially a lot of African-Americans passed them by. Yeah. Let them fend for themselves.
Yeah.
And white people stopped for them. Fixed it, wouldn't fix their car, and fixed it, put it together, and got them on the road. I could name probably as many wonderful things that have happened.
Yeah.
That were initiated
yeah.
by people who were not African American yeah. that helped, that did wonderful things as well. And that's why it makes it such a difficult
yeah.
situation.
Really?
Because sometimes you, as my father used to, my father used to say, you know, why aren't they thanking the Quakers for all the things they did for African Americans during slavery?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I say, I don't know who's Quaker, who's Klan.
Oh yeah, right.
No, and that's the issue. And that's one I live with. I live with that. I live with that almost everywhere I go.
Yeah.
And I'm and it's always a part of my life.
Yeah.
And that will be the more difficult things that I have to deal with. And as every African American in this country has to deal with. You know? And yeah. probably every white American in this country, because they don't know who they're coming across when they look at an African American.
Yeah.
They don't know if this is going to be the guy that's featured on America's Most Wanted, or Cops, or if, they, right. they, or if they're making a mistake, and this guy that's, that looks like he's, you know, got his hair cut a certain way, wearing right. a couple tennis shoes a certain way, or
yeah.
dressed his cap a certain way, is really studying at Juilliard.
Right.
you know, and you, and you can, so it becomes, so I think race has been an important part of my life.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be, but it has been. And yeah. it's one of those issues. One of the best, I guess one of the best things is, having a family, having yeah. a supportive family.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And they've been there for me when I needed them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've always come to help. I have a family that, if you're in trouble or if you need the help, my brothers were always there
yeah.
to come.
Yeah.
And they brought, not only did they come, but they, for the most part, brought that, I think that special thing that you carry in your heart,
yeah.
that I'm going to be there for you. I'm here because of you. I'm staying as long as you need me. I will be here, and I'm not leaving. And if you need me again, just call me.
Yeah.
And that's who my brothers are. So they've always been able to be there for me. So I've been blessed that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have the same. Like, I'm a recovering addict, so I put my family through hell.
Right.
And they never turned their back. They didn't enable. Mm-hmm. But as long as I was getting well, they have been there every step of the way, and luckily, like, I'm, you know, through that and have a beautiful relationship with
good,
them. So
good.
Family's so important. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of people don't have the fortune of
No, they don't.
Well, I was going to ask you, what inspires you in life is my last question, but I don't know if that was just the answer, or, I mean, like, I think if you want to end it there.
What inspires me in life?
Yeah, like, what's one of
your questions? When I see acts of kindness, total acts of kindness.
Beautiful.
You know, when I see people, when I see people doing something extraordinary for someone else.
Yeah.
If it's if it's even if it's day to day, if I see someone doing something, opening a door, picking up something, I'll help you with that.
Yeah.
Let me do that for you. Not for anything else, but just to help you. You need something? Here, just take it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's yeah. okay. Pass it along.
Yeah.
As they say, just pass it along. Yeah. Give it to somebody else. Give these good feelings. Give this favor that I did for you. Do a favor for somebody else.
And I teach that in my workshops all the time, because you never know the ripple effects that
that's
will
right.
have. Like,
that's right.
maybe that person's having a bad day. You
that's
hold
right.
the door.
That's
you give
right.
them a smile.
That's right.
Pay for their,
yeah.
you're in line at the toll. You
yes,
pay for them behind
yes,
you.
Yes.
And then who knows how far that
that's
goes.
Right.
So,
that's right. That's right.
Awesome, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
Right.
Thank you for being so, like, open. I really appreciate the right. depth of this conversation.
Thank you.
So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time as well. Like, it's been great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.